This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, residents who live near a Sterigenics plant in Willowbrook say chemicals used there are harming residents, with high incidence of cancer showing up.
This is not just affecting just Willowbrook, it's affecting Hinsdale, Darien, Burr Ridge. You know, it goes far and wide. And as the attorneys are getting into this and hiring their experts, it's going further and further out.
A commentator talks about her hometown's history with race and how it impacted her family directly. And is the University of Illinois doing enough to bring in minority students? We get to know the artist Preston Jackson, and we hear from some veterans who will be honored as part of the state's bicentennial, all coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, and a lot is ahead this hour. We'll hear how the issue of race played out for many years in a Chicago suburb and the impact it had on one family. We talk with a resident who urges state lawmakers to change how one company operates. She says a chemical being used is making people sick. And more on the role money played in an expensive race for Illinois governor. That and more coming up on Statewide. We're hearing more in the news lately about cases of rape or sexual assault. The increased awareness and very different public responses are focusing attention on many of the ways the system fails victims. For Illinois Newsroom, Steph Whiteside reports on what some in Illinois are doing to bring greater support to survivors.
Sexual violence is an issue that touches the lives of millions of Americans.
Close to 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men are victims of some form of sexual violence, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner.
Megan Thomas works for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Even with greater awareness, advocates say we are still struggling to understand how rape and sexual assault affect victims and how the process of seeking justice can add to the trauma. Thomas notes that the number of survivors is just an estimate, because most victims of sexual violence don't report. Polly Poskin is executive director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She says that has a lot to do with culture and an unwillingness to believe victims.
Why would you tell somebody, or why would you open your mouth about something that happened to you that you have learned just kind of by being alive that nobody's going to believe me?
One big issue is a lack of understanding about the various responses to trauma.
In the moment of that sexual assault, we go into our survival instincts.
Diana Dickey is a therapist specializing in trauma.
When our bodies and our brains are triggered to go into that survival, we either go into fight, flight, or freeze.
Most people are familiar with the fight or flight concept, but freezing is a response people are less familiar with. Freeze, Diana says, happens when fight or flight isn't an option.
It's almost like it's our brain's last line of defense, where we may not be able to protect our bodies, but we can protect our brain.
The person experiencing trauma may dissociate or check out in an effort to protect their mind from what is happening to their body. Without a clear understanding of trauma, Poskin emphasizes the importance of first responders not passing judgment before an investigation.
Don't be making preliminary decisions about whether this is a bona fide case or a believable case or a credible case until you look at that evidence.
Another issue is the investigation itself. In addition to questioning by law enforcement, a victim may also elect to have a rape kit taken to gather evidence. This exam can take 4 hours or more. It's excruciatingly detailed, swabbing and combing and probing the victim's body, which has now become a crime scene. The invasiveness can add more trauma for the victim. Nurses can undergo specialized training to perform these exams, but not all hospitals have those experts on staff. ICASA has been working to change that.
By the year 2022, we'll have a qualified medical personnel in the emergency departments to respond to rape victims. And for us, that means sexual assault nurse examiners.
A trained nurse can speed up the time spent performing the exam, making it less traumatizing for the patient. There's another reason this training is so essential. It's about correctly collecting evidence in a way that will hold up in court.
The reason to do evidence collection properly, the reason to swab for the DNA, is to make sure you have the individual who perpetrated the crime, not somebody who didn't.
Illinois has been working on laws to make reporting and prosecution more effective and less traumatizing. One is a law requiring police to file a report anytime a sexual assault is reported, regardless of jurisdiction or how long ago the assault took place. Police and other first responders are also required to undergo training on how to interact with sexual assault victims. This law took effect in 2017.
There's standardized, required training. Some of it's in person, some of it's online.
Illinois was one of the first states to pass a law requiring an audit of backlogged rape kits, and as of today, all backlogged kits that were part of an ongoing investigation have been processed. What it really comes down to, says Poskin, is priorities.
We decided we want smoking to stop. It is impressive the amount of people power, brain power, money power that gets poured into campaigns and work. And that's just a matter of resources. That's a matter of prioritizing.
I'm Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration focused on education, politics, health, and the environment. Since the late 1970s, congressional leaders have placed food aid programs in the Farm Bill to attract votes from urban legislators. The thinking was that congressional representatives from the cities would support a bill aimed at rural areas if they could get help where food stamp use was highest, in the inner cities. Peggy Lowe with Harvest Public Media reports that may now change as the need has moved to a new area.
It's a busy football Saturday at this grocery store in rural southwest Iowa near the Iowa-Nebraska state line. Store manager Nick Johnson is working the checkout as folks buy hamburger, soda pop, and chips.
$8.20.
Johnson says times have been tough around here. Lots of people lost their manufacturing jobs during the recession, though he says that it looks like some of those are coming back. And farm income is down across the country thanks to low crop prices. In this tiny corner of Iowa, nearly 40,000 people get assistance from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what used to be known as food stamps. Most are white, and 40% live under the poverty level.
There's a lot of farmers in this community. There's a lot of people that have their own businesses, so they try to do the best they can.
Numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture show that since 2012, SNAP participation is highest among households in rural areas and small towns under 2,500 people.
But it wasn't shocking or surprising when you think about the degree to which SNAP is related to people being poor.
Ellen Volinger is with the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit fighting poverty-related hunger. The center analyzed the USDA data and found that nationally, 16% of households in rural areas use SNAP versus 13% in urban areas. Volinger says the elderly population is larger in rural areas, which is driving the increase.
And the data, if anything, probably suggests that there could be an even greater reach for SNAP in rural areas if it was doing a stronger job of reaching more of the elderly who are, in fact, eligible but not participating.
Volinger says other people in rural areas who need food aid are low-wage workers who just don't make enough or don't get enough hours at work. Many are families with children. Nick Johnson, the grocer, says that over the years, he's seeing more of his customers buying healthy food.
So you see more people with bread, milk, eggs, pasta.
About a fifth of his store's annual revenue comes from SNAP, Johnson says. And that's about average, according to David Proctor of the Rural Grocery Initiative at Kansas State University. He surveyed Kansas rural grocers on income from SNAP and another federal program that specifically helps mothers and children.
We get different percentages, I mean, from different owners, but, you know, anywhere from, say, 10% up to about 25% of their sales, they tell us, come from those federal food assistance programs.
Proctor says the federal food aid spent in grocery stores helps fuel small-town economies. He says those rural grocers need electricians, carpenters, and other service providers. USDA data shows that every dollar spent in SNAP generates up to $1.80 in economic activity in that area.
For every dollar that is spent in a local grocery store in SNAP, those dollars then translate into local economic development.
The other big winner with SNAP dollars? Chain stores that cater to rural areas like Dollar General. And the USDA says that last year, big box stores like Walmart took in more than half of the billions set aside for SNAP. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Voters in more than a dozen Illinois counties this past election approved ballot measures asking the state not to pass any more gun control bills. Peter Medlin takes a closer look.
In Illinois, the debate over gun control is even being raged in countywide elections. Floyd Hulkenbrink is the chairman of the Cumberland County Board. His county is one that had this issue on the ballot. He said a member of their community who runs a gun store and offers concealed carry classes first brought it to the board's attention.
And he was concerned about, so he came to the county board and asked us to pass a resolution saying we're opposed to some of these new laws they were going to make.
One of those would have required all Illinois gun dealers to be certified and registered with the state. After the resolution passed, they thought they should ask voters if they also agreed. The referendum passed with over 90% of the vote. Some of these ballot questions ask if they should become a sanctuary county for gun owners. This language evokes the broad term sanctuary cities, including Chicago, which have immigration policies that clash with federal guidelines. In central Illinois' Logan County, the ballot question linked immigration and the debate over gun control in an even more direct way. The question was a mouthful. Shall Logan become a sanctuary county for all firearms unconstitutionally prohibited by the government of the state of Illinois for everyone except for undocumented immigrants, in that Logan County will prohibit its employees from enforcing the unconstitutional actions of the state government? That measure passed with 63% of the vote. As for Chicago, Cook County also had a gun-related referendum. Unlike those other counties, Cook asked its voters if the state should require gun dealers to be licensed with the state. It also asked if Illinois should strengthen penalties for illegal firearm trafficking. It passed with over 90% of the vote. I'm Peter Medlin.
In 1959, the all-white North Shore suburb of Deerfield condemned a housing development that was in the process of being built after village officials discovered the developers intended to sell the homes to African Americans. The situation led Amy Roos' parents to give up a baby girl they'd adopted. The girl was half African American. For Illinois Issues, Roos talks more about that, the troubled racial history of Deerfield, and the integration issues that remain today.
While visiting my hometown of Deerfield, Illinois recently, I stopped by a lunch counter for an Italian beef. I encountered 80-year-old Barry Saffin, who was debating the diner's owner on a hot-button topic in Deerfield these days, affordable housing.
Are you making a living that you can afford housing somewhere close enough by? You have a car you drive here,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're supporting a family?
Yeah.
Many people don't have that. They work here, but they can't afford it. You say, they don't want it in your backyard. Well, it's not yours. Who's?
In his younger days, Barry would not have been welcome in Deerfield because he's Jewish. Today, Deerfield, a village of 18,000 mostly white residents, is home to a large Jewish community. However, it still struggles to roll out the welcome wagon. Case in point, a proposed workforce housing development known as Zion Woods that many Deerfieldians oppose.
I think most people's concern is about property value. And I get that that's a selfish thing, but it's a reality that many people have to face.
That was a Deerfield resident for whom Zion Woods is literally her backyard. She asked I not use her name because she didn't want her neighbors to, as she put it, come after her. The state requires 10% of all housing be designated for low-income individuals. However, because of its home rule status, Deerfield is exempt from this regulation. Mayor of Deerfield Harriet Rosenthal explains.
Well, the state gave home rule communities the ability not to provide the 10% workforce housing that the state was requiring. So statutorily, we don't have to do that. Ethically, morally, we are trying to provide.
I asked other Deerfield residents what they think of Zion Woods and why they think Deerfield is still so segregated. Most people I spoke to were unaware of a local controversy that made national headlines in 1959, a housing incident that in many ways echoes the Zion Woods debate. Deerfield librarian Dylan Zabagno explains.
Developer Morris Milgram purchased land to develop as suburban housing, but with a difference, his developments would be integrated. When Deerfield residents learned that the housing development was going to be integrated, many immediately opposed it. This was an all-white community. A lot of people opposed it because they opposed integration altogether.
Longtime Deerfield resident Art Shea described what he witnessed in an interview I conducted with him prior to his recent passing.
Well, one Sunday morning, a guy lived 2-3 houses up here, came around with his 5 children dressed for church. He was a co-pilot in my war, and he had one of his kids carrying a petition. He said, don't you want niggers to live on this street? And I said, what did we fight the war for, you know?
Early next year, the Deerfield Library will host a series of guest speakers, including, full disclosure, myself and Angel Smith, a child adopted by my parents in 1962 and then relinquished because her skin proved too dark for Deerfield. More about that story is included in the full-length version of this story, available online for Illinois Issues. This is Amy Roost reporting.
You can find out more about that story, and a link to it is at our website at statewideshow.com. Up next, a woman living near a plant in Chicago's suburbs says a chemical used there has resulted in health problems for many. Her story and more on the way on Statewide. Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a woman who says a plant in Chicago's suburbs has impacted her health and the health of other nearby residents. What she wants done about it, that's coming up. And a profile of the artist Preston Jackson, all ahead on Statewide. A recent study by the Institute for Higher Education Policy shows the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign stands out among similar schools for its low percentage of minority students. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes has details.
The study looked at flagship universities around the Great Lakes to gauge whether they offer equal access for underrepresented minorities and low-income students. I spoke with one of the authors, Mamie Voigt, who is also a vice president at the Institute of Higher Education Policy.
We essentially take a look at racial gaps and socioeconomic gaps in college access and completion for low-income students and students of color.
Which students would be included in those groups?
Black, Hispanic, and American Indian, Alaska Native students. So those are students who nationally are underrepresented in higher education.
This study used a really basic yardstick. The researchers simply compared each state's crop of high school graduates with the following year's freshman class at its main public university. The difference in minority representation between those two groups, that's the equity gap. Out of the 6 Great Lakes flagship universities, Illinois has the biggest gap by far.
So I'm looking at these two metrics at 6 campuses, and UIUC just jumps out that their access gap is 18 percentage points. Am I stating that correctly?
That is right. Mm-hmm.
And that's compared to 10 percentage points at Ohio State, 9 percentage points at Indiana University, 10 at University of Michigan, 7 at Minnesota, and 9 at Madison. It really sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, the access gaps at UIUC are pretty substantial for students of color. So while 20% of students at UIUC are students of color, 38% of high school graduates are that previous year. So there's an 18-point gap between the demographics of the high school graduating class and the entering freshman class. That's really substantial. And we've seen the gap really increase over time at UIUC. So since 2001, the access gap for students of color has actually doubled. It was 9 percentage points in 2001. It's up to 18 percentage points in 2016. So we see that this is moving in the wrong direction. And so there are sort of multiple things at play here, but a large part of it is that the state of Illinois is becoming far more diverse. And the university, which does have a responsibility to serve the students in their state as a public flagship institution, is failing to keep pace with those changing state demographics.
The study also tracks 5 university policies that can hinder minority enrollment, and UIUC does better than most. But Voigt says there's another factor that can't really be measured.
Really changing the trends in access for low-income students and students of color comes down to institutional leadership and setting priorities and making choices about how to use their resources and how to design their recruitment and enrollment and admissions efforts to really prioritize equity for students of color and low-income students.
I spoke with Kevin Pitts, UIUC's Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, and he acknowledged the gap, saying numbers don't lie. He said the university is trying several strategies designed to both recruit and support underrepresented minorities. But he also pointed out that Voigt's study doesn't quite capture the flavor of UIUC's student body. UIUC has more international students than almost any other school in the country, certainly more than any other Great Lakes flagship. Voigt's study doesn't specifically address this issue. She says international students would just count as out-of-state admissions, and that's a trend that's been increasing nationwide.
So at UIUC, they've increased the percent of students who are from out of the state of Illinois by 21 percentage points over the last 30 years. And that can work against these efforts to open opportunity and serve students in the state who are from low-income backgrounds or who are students of color, because they tend to be recruiting higher-income students from out of state who can pay those higher tuition charges.
UIUC charges international students an additional surcharge up to $5,000 above the out-of-state rate. Vice Provost Pitts says half of those charges go into a fund that provides scholarships for Illinois students, some of whom are minorities or low income. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
A reminder, you can find our shows at statewideshow.com. This week's episode and past episodes are available there. You can also find our podcast at NPR One. After a federal public health agency released reports showing the areas around a sterilizing facility in Chicago's suburbs have increased rates of cancer due to ethylene oxide emissions, Illinois lawmakers and residents want answers. Sterigenics in Willowbrook uses ethylene oxide to sterilize medical and surgical equipment. Jeannie Hohalter grew up near the plant and was diagnosed with breast cancer as an adult. She urged state senators in Springfield to ban the chemical. Hohalter sat down with our reporter, Daisy Contreras, to talk about her mission.
Tell me about your journey and how you are making the cancer connection to these emissions from having lived near one of these facilities.
Well, originally, I did not make that connection. I went through the cancer journey, and in August, when the reports came out, my mom and I looked at the list and checked off everything that was I've had in my life, and it was quite numerous. So that's where the connection started coming in and my belief that they have poisoned me. We have no BRCA history, no family history. So, you know, it's quite coincidental that most of the things on that list are applicable to me and so many other community members.
Tell me a little bit more about these community members. During your testimony, you held up some photographs. Tell me about those.
There are many children in the area that have lymphoma, leukemia. Again, no history, no reason why they should have this at all. I held up beads of hope. The little girl in the picture is, I think she's a sophomore now, but she's just been through so much with cancer, and there's no cure for her. She had over 5,000 beads of hope when she last stopped counting. So, you know, we just really need to do this for the children, and so parents can lay their head down at night and know that their kids are safe.
This is a Willowbrook plant, but you did not grow up in Willowbrook.
Correct.
Tell me about the area that you lived in.
So I grew up next to Willowbrook, a mile as a crow flies, as they say. And so Timber Ridge, this is not just a Willowbrook problem. This is an area problem. This is not just affecting just Willowbrook. It's affecting Hinsdale, Darien, Burr Ridge. You know, it goes far and wide. And as the attorneys are getting into this and hiring their experts, it's going further and further out.
Industry experts who testified and said that they believe that these are safe, that the chemical used in sterilizing medical equipment is safe, and it's the only way for them to be able to do what they have to do. How do you feel hearing that?
Well, I feel that, first of all, there is no safe level of ethylene oxide emissions, no safe level. And the harmful effects are long-term exposure. And once you're exposed, you're exposed. It can mutate, I believe, your DNA. And so we don't know what our kids are facing. But it's a little disheartening to hear them when they see pictures of actual victims of this. It's really disheartening to hear them come out and say the need. But the legislators were fantastic in the questions that they asked.
There's also this business side to the issue, right? These plants, if there's a ban, they would have to find alternative, affordable ways to do the job that they do or shut down.
Well, there are definitely alternatives that we have groups of scientists and doctors and so forth in our community in this group that have determined there are very acceptable alternatives. Now, it costs companies to change over. So they're looking at their profits. And again, as I testified, the profits on the back of the community and of the children in the community and the victims and patients, and they can't do that.
After speaking to legislators, after being part of this hearing and listening to what legislators had to say, what do you think is their perspective or where they stand on the issue?
I think we have a lot of support, and we're going to work very hard as a community to get this banned. We're in this for the long haul, so that's what the intent is. So we will definitely do what we need to do to work with the legislators that might not be on our side.
That's Jeannie Hohalter, a cancer survivor who grew up near the Sterigenics plant in Willowbrook. The plant is under investigation for high ethylene oxide emissions. Sterigenics officials say they've been compliant with current regulations. 200 men and women from across Illinois have been named to the state's Bicentennial Honor 200 list. They're being recognized as military veterans who continue to serve their communities. Susan Stevens spoke with two Rockford veterans who will be honored in December at the state's 200th birthday celebration.
John Borling and Stanley Campbell both served in Vietnam, but their time in the service took them in very different directions when they returned home. Major General John Borling, U.S. Air Force, retired, is career military. His 37 years in the Air Force, many as a fighter pilot, included 6.5 years as a prisoner of war in Hanoi. Stanley Campbell enlisted in 1969, was sent to Germany, then volunteered for Vietnam so he could leave the service 4 months early. Campbell handled paperwork for the doctors and nurses of the Army's 67th Medical Group. He returned to Rockford a changed man. But we'll get to that story in a few minutes. General John Borling is a Chicago native who moved to Rockford 17 years ago for family reasons. Making the state's Bicentennial Honor 200 list is a nice intersection of his military and community service.
Very pleased to have been nominated and chosen and feel honored by the inclusion, humbled that I might be joining such a distinguished group.
Borling has run for U.S. Senate, published a book of poems he had tapped out to fellow prisoners in Vietnam, and currently is a trustee and regent for the Lincoln Academy of Illinois. That organization awards the state's highest honor, the Order of Lincoln.
And over the years, I've tried to lend what efforts and wisdom I could offer, modest to be sure, to worthy enterprises that advance the American spirit, as well as be active in the business community.
Borling's biggest investment currently is as founder and chairman of an organization called Service Over Self. 1 year of nation-building service would be required of every male between the ages of 18 and 26. Women could volunteer.
The problem with the all-volunteer force is that a very small percentage of Americans, male and female, can qualify to be part of the all-volunteer force. It's quite strenuous physically and also from a mental standpoint. But the notion is, wouldn't it be good to have an option for just a year of service to augment the all-volunteer force, but to do it in a small unit, no larger than 100, mixed geography from across the country, so that north and south, east and west meet, mix ages. Boy, the 18-year-old is much different than the 20, much different than the 22 or 26-year-old.
And mixed education and socioeconomic levels, too. Borling sees these forces performing support tasks for the military.
For example, if we needed some people for helping to rebuild Puerto Rico or to clean up after storms or to provide presence at the border, for God's sakes, we could have these people, quote, overnight. And they would come in an orderly fashion with organization. In order to be able to perform tasks, I call it nation building in America, that are required.
Borling says it's an uphill battle and will take legislation, but he thinks it's worth it to bring a military bonding experience to more people. Stanley Campbell is being honored by the state of Illinois for his service in the Army and for his anti-war activities following his return from Vietnam.
First of all, I'm honored because I'm sure that there are at least 2,000 veterans out there that are doing good stuff in the communities and that could be honored as well. I'm thinking that I'm one of the lucky ones that was actually nominated. It was, again, a surprise because I know a number of veterans here in Rockford who do much more than I do. And who deserve it much more than I do.
Campbell went to Vietnam as a supporter of America's mission there and returned home to Rockford with a very different mindset. He says he marched against the war, was angry, felt betrayed by his government, then discovered peace through helping others while attending Rock Valley College. There he founded the Rock River Valley Pantry and went on to become executive director of Rockford Urban Ministries and, as he likes to put it, the only paid peace activist in Rockford. He credits his experiences in the military for helping make him who he is today.
I went in with preconceived notions about war and justice and the enemy and had it flip-flopped. And so I've always been careful now about considering what is the enemy, what is wrong, how do we approach problems in the world. I'm not such a firm believer that the government has all the answers, and I really think that individuals can make a difference if they band together and work on something. So I tell people that if I hadn't gone to Vietnam, I'd probably be working for Ali North. And so I'm happy that I served. I'm proud of the time that I spent in there, but I know that the mission that the soldiers were called to do was so incorrect and so horrifyingly wrong. So I'm glad I served. I'm especially glad that I went to Vietnam, but I'm also proud of the fact that I came back, found other veterans to march against that war, and then see those veterans work on other projects within the community to make the community a better place.
What does Veterans Day mean to you?
For me, it's a good time to remember what a person that goes through a war brings home and how we treat that person then and try to bind up the wounds. We could just, you know, ignore them, pat them on the back, tell them to be a man, or we could really search and say, is there a way to heal this and is there a way to prevent this from happening in the future?
Stanley Campbell, John Borling, and 198 other Illinois veterans will be honored December 3rd when the state throws its bicentennial birthday party. I'm Susan Stevens.
Coming up on Statewide, we chat with the Illinois artist Preston Jackson, and we'll hear more about the role of money in Illinois politics. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, a profile of the artist Preston Jackson. And a reminder, if you missed any episodes of our program or want to hear them again, you can check our website, statewideshow.com. A podcast is available through NPR One. Illinois' billionaire governor-elect J.B. Pritzker is now the richest politician in America, and that has led critics to question how much the Democrats' personal wealth may have influenced his election win. Our Sam Dunklaw got in touch with Kent Redfield, a campaign finance expert from the U of I Springfield, to talk about the role money plays in state politics, and if the most expensive governor's race raises the bar in competing for the state's top office.
Does this speak to how important money is in politics? I mean, we hear sort of politicians on both sides of the aisle kind of knock this idea, well, there needs to be campaign finance reform. But clearly, money is very important.
Yeah. Money, in a very general sense, money is a threshold question. You need a certain amount of money to be visible. People have to know that you exist and that you're running. You need a certain amount of money to be viable, particularly if you don't have kind of star power, name recognition. If the political winds or the issues are on your side, or if you're, a really outstanding candidate in terms of the way you come across to the public, money helps you get that out there. But most of the time in the legislative offices, but particularly statewide elections, you're in a dynamic where the candidates and the campaigns do matter. There's so much uncertainty in politics as far as what's actually going to work or doesn't work. But a lot of this money is clearly overkill and wasted.
Was Rauner and some of his Republican allies up in the suburbs, I mean, I was looking at some of these legislative races, like Peter Breen got knocked out pretty significantly, the floor leader in the House. What was the deal? Were they just simply fatalist candidates? Were they victims of the national headwind, or was it really a money question?
Well, the unsatisfying answer is all of the above. Certainly, when you do the postmortem on Rauner versus Pritzker, then Rauner was a terribly flawed candidate going to this election because of his lack of accomplishments, because of that he didn't wear well with the public, because of the budget impasse. Then Rauner gave all the money that Rauner put into his campaign. He put in before the 1st of January of 2017. He put in $50 million right at the end of 2016. And I think there probably became a point in this campaign where he said, with the money that I'm able to spend, that I've got, if I can't beat him on the issues that I have with the money I've got, and another $25 million is not going to make any difference. But when you get down to the legislative level, certainly you had well-funded candidates and a lot of really good recruiting of candidates in the suburbs. Those are areas that have been changing over the last two decades. And it was their first opportunity to to register dissatisfaction at the polls with what was going on. And so anybody that was running as a Republican became, was vulnerable in terms of, that area.
Now that Pritzker is heading off to the governor's mansion, he says, and he said this multiple times throughout the campaign, that he's for campaign finance reform. So when Pritzker says things like that, I'm for campaign finance reform, while at the same time spending some $170+ million on his own gubernatorial campaign, can he be serious about something like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, constitutionally, you can't keep him from spending his own money. The court has been very adamant for a long period of time that money is speech. Spending money on campaign is protected speech. I think probably the things that would help would be more transparency, so people knew where the money was coming from. That would require, more teeth in the State Board of Elections, but particularly at the federal level with the IRS and the Federal Elections Commission, to get at the dark money and the phony non-for-profits that are really just political action committees, so that the public knows where the money's coming from, who are you taking money from, what are the conflicts of interest that creates. But there really isn't any solution at this point to allow us to constitutionally take this kind of big money out of politics.
That's Sam Dunklaw speaking with the U of I Springfield's Kent Redfield. For our next interview, we head to Peoria, where Rachel Otwell sat down with an artist who says his work can't be separated from politics.
Preston Jackson grew up in Decatur. He was part of a large family, and he began drawing at a young age. While he says his dyslexia made certain parts of learning hard, he went on to be a professor at multiple colleges, including the Art Institute of Chicago. He has art studios in that city, as well as in Peoria, where I joined him to talk about his latest work, a mural depicting a scene from the 1908 race riot in Springfield, which led to the founding of the NAACP. Its unveiling was this week, and it will remain on display at St. John's Hospital Women's and Children's Clinic.
Nuns took care of people, carried them in, healed their wounds, kept them clean and comfortable. But the important part is that they were placed side by side, white and black patients. The only thing that the nuns were aware of is that these people need their service. These people need help. I don't want audiences to forget there was love for those involved, and they were placed side by side, probably conversing, you know. Isn't that an irony?
And so we've been talking about how your work involves history, and a lot of the time it's these histories that we don't talk about as much as a society.
Right.
People in Springfield, some still don't know that it's the home of the NAACP and that this mm-hmm. massacre happened where two innocent black men were lynched. But you've also dealt with history that's a little more well known. You created a Richard Pryor sculpture, comedian and Peoria native. You've done an Obama bust. We've been talking about how you merge history and art in this visceral way.
Well, it's not like I did this on purpose, you know. I grew up responding to the events during my childhood. That has never been all roses, because many things have happened, especially in my career as an artist and the color of my skin. Even today, as we sit here, I still have pressures, reactions to the extra things that I have to be aware of. That takes up energy, takes up time, takes up money, you know. All of these things that's attached to me simply by being black, you know, that's quite a weight, you know. And I am not that happy with today's government and what's happening, especially to the poor, the veterans, and also the street people that I'm around quite a bit. My art career, I can say, is sharing something about making this a better world. So I'm looking at a weight on my shoulders that I'm constantly pushing around to feel better, both physically and mentally.
And you touched on this, but I was going to ask, since politics is something you speak out about freely and clearly inspires you, what about current politics, especially perhaps in the last 2 years? What are your feelings there, and does that bleed into the artwork?
My work has always been political. I would love to not have to paint things about this particular time. These are dangerous times, very dangerous times with our president. And I feel, because of my knowledge of history, delving so deep into the history, what happened in Germany, you know, this whole thing of a totalitarian government, this bullying, this idea of shutting down the press. I know what happened to the artists during Nazi Germany and Stalin. What happened to these people? Very famous artists, great artists. Somehow we look at them, you know, we're talking about Picasso and Kollwitz and Kokoschka and all of these artists that spoke out against imprisonment of people. Artists today, I feel, are not doing enough, and visual artists especially. They go comfortably to their studios. I mean, it's kind of like creating an elite artist society above the people. I mean, when I look at Bill Traylor's work, you know, and Kerry James Marshall, it was directly about and for the people. Sorry to say that my generation and the artists that I'm around and know, you know, the people at the Art Institute, most of my friends in Chicago, I don't see or experience any strong commentary about where we are politically.
Some people might wonder why that's the role of an artist, to comment on politics. Why do you see that as being your role?
Simply because you're alive. Most artists, I don't feel, are opening their eyes and their hearts to reality. It took me a long time to get representation in a gallery, which I still don't have. I have a lot of art out there, public things, because I win a lot of competitions, you know. But I've never been offered galleries. And a lot of the competitions that I've won is simply because of cities and people finding someone that fit. And, of course, I don't fit. Neither does my subject. But I survive, and I continue. And I hate to put it in these words, I become very good at my art.
You were listed as one of the top 10 Illinois artists, along with Frank Lloyd Wright and Vivian Mayer were also on that list, and it was compiled in honor of the state's bicentennial. You're definitely a quote-unquote Renaissance man in the sense of prolific output, which we're surrounded by right now, and the diversity of your talents. You were doing Tai Chi when we got here. You play guitar. You're an educator for children here at this Contemporary Art Center in Peoria, Professor Emeritus, Art Institute of Chicago. The list goes on. There's so many various forms of art you do even. What do you want your own legacy to be? We've been talking about the legacy of Black people in America and specific historical figures. Do you think about your own legacy?
I have. Lately, I've been thinking about mortality. They say at some point of your life, that idea of it will become stronger, and I think it has, you know. What I want to leave here, I think, what I want to see happen is that the planet survives. That's first of all. Politics don't mean squat. You know, when you don't have a planet, there's no place to live. Science has proven planets die, just like stars die, you know. Everything has its day, its ending. What I would like to see is that the blending of human beings, all human beings on the face of the earth, coming together to preserve the earth. I chose to be representational. I was trained, not trained, but when I worked on my MFA, my work was a pure abstract, strictly abstract. You know, it's affected, you know, by great artists. Richard Hunt of Chicago was one of my favorites. Frank Gallo, and really great artists. So I chose to use representational art to make it plain, you know, that old saying, make it plain. I wanted to offer art to the people of all levels of education. I want them to feel it, not just see it, but to feel the subject right away and connect to it and say something like, hey, that could be me, or that's how I feel, you know? But I think the artists, you know, themselves, they should really try hard to include others and everyone and say it direct. Don't be afraid. If you don't speak up, no one is going to get into a better position. So artists, you know, get some guts.
That was Preston Jackson, an Illinois artist who recently finished a mural displayed at a Springfield hospital depicting Catholic nuns and the patients they cared for who were injured in the 1908 race riot. You can find out more information and see a picture. It's all available. Just go to our website at statewideshow.com. That will do it for another edition of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week at this time. I'm Sean Crawford. A reminder, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.